Welcome to podcast number 127 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is May 11th, 2021, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest today is Lisa Gray. Lisa is an Amazon number one, also Washington Post and Wall Street Journal bestselling author. She previously worked as the chief Scottish football writer at the Press Association and book columnist at the Daily Record Saturday magazine. Her debut novel, Thin Air, was a Washington Post and Wall Street Journal bestseller and was Amazon's third best-selling Kindle ebook of 2019. Bad Memory was a Wall Street Journal bestseller and longlisted for the McIlvaney Prize. Dark Highway, the third book in the Jessica Shaw series, was published in November of 2020. Lisa now writes full-time. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. My Favorite Detective Stories features crime fiction writers who discuss their latest books and what makes their fictional detectives tick. Throughout my investigative career spanning five decades, I cannot think of a time that I didn't have a good crime novel on my coffee table or bedstand. We will also talk about their favorite authors as well. On alternating weeks, we are introducing a new podcast, How to Rocket Your PI Business, featuring successful private investigators. They offer insights into their careers and advice for those just starting out or for those who are struggling. We will learn from the best. And of course, we cannot finish the show without asking them to share a few of their favorite detective stories and sage marketing tips. As a working investigator, coach, and writer, I hope to bring you inspiration, information, and entertainment in the areas that interest me most. Gather around my campfire as I invite you to listen in. This episode of My Favorite Detective Stories is brought to you by my own crime thriller with a mystery twist, Odessa on the Delaware, introducing Marcia O'Shea, my debut novel. A Russian gang enforcer is on a murderous rampage to take over the entire Philadelphia mob scene. A homeless vet doesn't know that he has the proof or that he's next on the list. The stakes are high for this deadly cat-and-mouse game set on the bleak Philly waterfront of years gone by. FBI agent Marcia O'Shea, a gunslinger from the Miami drug cartel days, is back in her hometown, quietly finishing out her career, but is now drawn into this case with a secret pushing her doggedly to follow the clues, only to uncover a greater secret that may get her killed in the final showdown. I'm excited to talk about Odessa on the Delaware, and for my readers and listeners, it is now free at my website, www.johnhoda.com. I'm glad to offer this book to you as a way of introducing you to FBI agent Marcia O'Shea, because the series with her continues with Clearwater Blues, Detroit Wheels, and West Reading Traffic. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really glad that you were able to come on today. So tell me how the weather is out there in beautiful Glasgow today.
Well, it's very dark. It's very wet today. It's not too cold. It's around 10 degrees, which is probably cold for other people, but not so much here. We did have some snow last week. The snow's gone. So now it's just the rain and that's not so much fun.
No, I don't think so. Today in southwestern Connecticut, as we record, and we're recording on February the 12th, 2021, it's a snowy day. It was snowy yesterday, and it's snowy again today. Getting my exercise in, that's for sure. But anyway, Robert Tagone, who's a previous podcast guest on the show, recommended that I give you a call, and you were gracious enough to come on. I appreciate Bob's recommendation and referral. And looking at the stuff that you've written, I can see why. And I really appreciate that. So I'm just going to let you tell me, how did you get started with your writing? When did it become, you know, most time and then full time? Just walk me through your story arc, I guess, for a lack of a better word.
Well, I think probably like most writers, I started off being a reader, first of all. I was really quite big into books as a youngster. I was never out of the library. I was a big fan of Judy Blume, Sweet Valley High, Point Horror, Dean Koontz, all that kind of stuff. So I think I was probably more into scary, spooky mysteries, first of all, before I really got into the crime stuff later on. But I think I was quite young when I decided that I didn't really want to do a normal job as such. that I quite liked the idea of being paid to write. But even at that age, probably around 10 or 11 years old, it just didn't seem realistic to have a job that is writing books. So I decided quite early on I was going to be a journalist and write for magazines. So I don't know how much more realistic that was, because I thought I was going to interview celebrities and have a very glamorous lifestyle. And I did become a journalist, but it wasn't quite as glamorous as I'd hoped it might have turned out to be. So it was really feature writing that I wanted to do, glossy magazines, human interest stories, but I kind of ended up being a sports reporter by mistake, almost, or by accident, if you want to look at it that way. And the reason that came about was, as you can probably imagine, it's really quite tough to break into newspapers, and it's all about building up a portfolio, trying to get bylines. And a friend of mine from college had started off covering some football, or as you would say, soccer matches at the weekend, and had then been offered a job on quite a big national newspaper. So basically one day I thought, well, I could do that as well. So I picked up the phone and I phoned the Daily Record, which is one of the big newspapers in Scotland, and asked if I could speak to the sports editor. And I was quite shocked when he took the call, and even more shocked when he agreed to give me a game that weekend to cover. And it just kind of went from there. So as much as I studied journalism, that part of it wasn't unexpected, but I suppose the specific sport side of it was quite unexpected. So that was really how the writing started off in that sense, before I then moved on to thinking about wanting to write fiction.
Okay. So did you go to school for journalism?
Yeah, I went to college for 2 years. So it was a 2-year diploma at a college in Glasgow. And when I graduated, as I say, found it really tough to try and get a job on a newspaper. So I took a job as a secretary at the University of Glasgow, and just in weekends and evenings tried to write stuff, features, sending it off, pitching people, just desperately trying to get some features and some bylines in the newspapers.
Bylines writing.
Yeah.
And trying to get some exposure and to build up your portfolio. So when you became a sports writer and you had to cover that match, did you understand the game? Did you know it?
Yeah, I was a big fan of football, and everyone in my family is really big football fans. So yeah, I kind of knew enough, I think, to get by early on. Probably not as much as I thought I knew when it comes to actually reporting on it as a job, but obviously that's something that comes the more you do it, you pick up more knowledge and you get to understand everything a bit more, and you get to know the game much better.
Yeah, but you seem to persevere. You didn't just stay writing for the paper. You also continue to pitch other features and try to get other magazine placements.
Yeah, so I kept doing that for a while, and then it became apparent that it was going to be the sports for a while once I got offered a full-time job as a junior sports reporter at a national news agency. So I kind of thought, well, this is the way that the career is going to be for quite some time. But also bubbling away in the background was this nagging feeling that it's an interesting job, but it's not really what I wanted to do. And the game changer for me was I started going to the big crime writing festivals, because by then I was really into reading people like Karen Slaughter and Mark Billingham, Harlan Coben, all those kind of people. So I started going to the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival just as a reader, to go and watch panels and meet people and get talking to people. And there were quite a few people like me who wanted to write books as well. And they were kind of like starting off on that journey. They were getting agents, they were getting publishers. And that really motivated me to think, this is really what I want to be doing, rather than the sports reporting, which is a fantastic job, but I knew it was really the writing crime novels was what I was really quite passionate about doing.
I understand this quite myself, because for many, many years, you know, I loved doing what I did. It wasn't what other people sometimes refer to as the dreaded day job. I loved it. And it sounds like you loved what you did too, but there was also something that you were more passionate about, something that went to the crime writing festivals. You could see that this is where you wanted to be, or this is where you aspired to be.
given the type of people that you just mentioned. This is some really heavy, good writing. And it was also the kind of writing that turned you on to wanting to then dip your toe into this genre and go after it. So talk to me about that a little bit, about how you started gradually moving to making the time to learn the craft and also start writing in the fiction genre.
Yeah, well, I think what I did was I thought about writing a book for a long time, and I spoke about it a lot with people, but it took a really long time before I had the confidence and the courage, I think, to actually write that first draft. Because every time I saw someone else getting an agent or getting a publishing deal, I would think, what if I'm the one that's the failure that this doesn't happen for? And I suppose a dream stays a dream until you try to make it a reality, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does.
So
it does.
I think I enjoyed this idea of, oh, this could be the dream one day. One day I could be a published crime writer. But it took a long time, I think, before I had the confidence. And then, of course, you need the right idea and the right character as well. And then eventually having, as I say, going to a lot of these festivals, listening to what authors were saying, picking up loads of tips and hints and all that kind of stuff from people who had already been on that publishing journey. Eventually, I thought, oh, okay, now I have to sit down and actually write this book, because by that point, I had the beginnings of the idea for the book that became Thin Air, which was this woman who finds out one day that she's not the person she always thought she was. And then once I decided she was going to be a private investigator who finds missing people, the hook came from that she finds missing people, but she doesn't know that she herself has been a missing person for 25 years. So once I had that, I knew I had to sit down and write this book.
Oh, man. Goosebumps. I'm sitting here with goosebumps already. But, you know, Lisa, what you were saying is, and it's so true, and I find this, that everyone's journey takes as many steps as it takes to get to where they are. I mean, I know that sounds very trite or almost zen, but it took, you know, being in the sports writing world, it took pitching ideas to magazines, the glossies, and trying to get bylines. It took going to the crime writing festivals to slowly chip away at all those barriers and self-made obstacles, and maybe some other obstacles like craft that you had to overcome. But it wasn't until you were ready that Thin Air came to you. Is that the fair way to say it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, because people then said, once I had a publishing deal for Thin Air, oh, do you not wish you had done this years ago? And I've seen, well, no, because obviously that wasn't the right time. And as you say, I think it was a good thing that I had all those years, 20 years almost, of the journalism, a different kind of writing, but it's still writing, as you say, it's still honing your craft. It's also going to all those festivals, finding out a bit more about that whole crime writing community, what it takes to be part of that. So I think the time was right when it happened. I don't regret not doing it before, if that makes sense.
It makes perfectly good sense. I had an idea kicking around in my head for close to 20 years. I had the beginning, I had the end, but I didn't have the middle. And it wasn't until like 2010 or 2011 that I finally got the middle. And then I decided, well, I'm going to write this story. And I had to learn how to write fiction. I had never written fiction before. I had written in trade journals. I had written in industry magazines. I had written instructional information, training materials, all related to my business or my art, but nothing, you know, from a fiction standpoint. But I could not have put pencil to paper, as they say, until that moment, because that was the time when it had to happen. Maybe I could have gotten that story idea earlier, but I might not have been in the right place in my life. Maybe I would have thought, oh, I can't write. What's my chance? So, you know, I agree with you 100% that the timing of it was exactly what it needed to be. Zen as it might sound, it is the truth. No sooner and no later. Now, so how did you start making time for your writing while still holding down the day job?
Yeah, well, that was very many late nights, but there had always also been a change there at one point, because this point I was no longer working full-time as a sports journalist. I had taken another job at the Daily Record newspaper. Funnily enough, that paper that I first started out doing that very first football match, but it was more commercial feature writing, and it was 4 days a week, and it was a much more regular 9-to-5 job. So that was another game changer, because I no longer had the working every weekend, working late nights, because when you work in sport, it is really quite full on, as you can imagine. It's not a regular 9-to-5 job. But by this point, that was something that was really quite important. By that point, I'd moved on to do something slightly different that was more 9-to-5. And I had the luxury of those 3 days over a weekend to really sit down and do the thing that I'd always wanted to do, which was to write a crime novel.
Well, you know, and again, the stars align themselves, the right occupation at the right time, being able to do that. I know in my own journey, it was writing on Wednesday nights and Sundays. I still worked my 50 hours a week doing my thing, but, you know, Wednesday night, come hell or high water, I had my fanny in the chair, my hands on the keyboard. And then on Sunday, after my morning obligations Sunday morning, I had the afternoon to just have the luxury of writing. And I called it a luxury. I don't know how you felt about it, but the thought that you could immerse yourself in a novel of your own creation, that you could sit there. Well, why don't you describe it to me? What do those 3 days feel like in terms of doing it?
I mean, I think that's exactly what you say, is it was a luxury. It didn't feel like, once I stepped out of the office for the weekend, this was the chance to escape into that other the world that I wanted to occupy with this private investigator and these mysteries to solve. And so, yeah, definitely a luxury, as you say. That was my time to kind of focus on the thing that I was feeling a bit more passionate about.
And but you also had some training. When you went to the writing festivals and the classes, you probably spent some time learning about structure, maybe not outline, but character, point of view, protagonist, what are the stakes that they have, how to write beats, how to write scenes. Can you talk a little bit about that, how you enveloped all that earlier information so that you could then incorporate that into those 3-day weekends?
I actually think I go back to the thing where reading is so important, because I think before I even went to any of these festivals and listened to what people say, as you say, about all those things about structure and beats and characterization, I think if you immerse yourself in books enough and you read the kind of books that you want to write, I think a lot of that really soaks into your subconscious. So I think a lot of that comes quite naturally, and you maybe don't even realise it. You know where the midpoint twist should be, and you know the final confrontation, what kind of things should happen in that, and how that character should develop throughout the book. So I would definitely say, I think, For anyone who wants to write books, the best thing you can do is read, 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 and completely immerse yourself in the kind of books that you want to write.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. As I said to you off air before we started, for the 40 years of my investigative career, I always had a good crime novel on my nightstand or my bedstand. You mentioned some heavyweights. I'll mention some myself. Lawrence Block, Michael Connelly, John Grisham for the legal thrillers, Laura Lippman for Tess Monahan, Martin Cruz Smith with the Arkady Renko novels. Those were the people that, you know, I read. And like you said, when it came time to start writing, you understood the importance of voice. You understood the importance of tone, description, setting, because you had seen it and you had seen it done so well. It was just a matter of now you rubbing your hands together and say, okay, how can I tell this story? And do it in a way that would be not so much paying homage or certainly not replicating or mimicking, but how can I write in a way that makes me feel really good about what I'm writing and that it's genuine in it and it's something that I like to read myself? Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly spot on, as you say. You read a lot of the people that you had mentioned there, and I think it's a natural thing that you kind of pick up. What is it about that character? What is it about Harry Bosch that makes you want to keep coming back and spend time with him? And as you say, you don't want to mimic or copy people, but I think you do subconsciously pick up the things that really just makes you want to spend time with that character. And it's trying to come up with that yourself, but your own character and someone that is different from all those characters and authors that you mentioned mm-hmm. before.
But I have to tell you, I left one name out of my nightstand, bedstand reading, and I'm going to mention it now. Robert Galbraith.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, I never read any of that writer's earlier stuff. And then one day I picked up, I think the first one was The Cuckoo's Calling. And I read that and I became a fan of Robert Galbraith all through those five books. I even picked up the DVD of the BBC shows that did, I think they did a fairly good job of telling the story that Galbraith wrote. And I felt that it was very, very interesting. What I'm really saying is that I became a fan and I can't wait for the next one to come out. And I know I'm on that writer's newsletter list. And I know there's going to be a few more Cormoran Strike novels. Also, I'm enjoying the co-protagonist, Robin Ellicott, who is also in that story. Have you read any of Galbraith's stuff?
I haven't. I've watched the TV show that you mentioned, and I've never read the books, and I've not read that author's other stuff either that you referred to. So I think it's something that I have to remedy that and maybe have to give those books a go as well.
I'm going to say this out loud. I haven't read Thin Air yet. So when I do, you may become my next favorite author. But until then, Lisa, I'm going to put it out that the Cormoran Strike novels are probably the best detective novels that I've ever read, ever. Now, some people might argue, you know, well, of course, it's British and that she writes definitely. Oh, I said she. I'm sorry. That Galbraith writes about what Galbraith knows. But I'm going to tell you, it's just really good stuff. So until I read Thin Air, I'm going to say that Galbraith's my number one lead. So you started writing. Go ahead.
And is that private eye fiction specifically? Or
No.
Is that for all detective fiction, you think that author's the best?
Private eye, yeah. Not necessarily detective.
Private eye fiction, yeah.
I'm not going to say anything against some of my police detective or FBI or, I guess in your world, detective superintendents or detective inspectors. Am I getting that right? DIs, DCIs.
Well, again, the books I write are all set in America, so I'm probably not the best person other than what I read in UK crime novels in terms of UK police procedural knowledge.
I know I'm just kind of meandering here, but for me, I'm going to go out on that limb. I haven't said this yet on any of the podcasts that my most favorite writer now is Robert Galbraith. Well, until I read your stuff. So
I would definitely give those books a go.
If she, like Dickens, Galbraith gets paid by the word. I'm only kidding. but they're lengthy. Let me tell you. they're lengthy. And I enjoy them a great deal. But
in fact, a friend of mine has just finished the most recent one, and he's a really prolific writer. And I think it took him about 3 months to finish this book, because I was actually joking, saying, I think you started this book before the pandemic even started. It feels like you've been reading it forever, and I think it has something like 900 pages. But again, like you, he says it was absolutely fantastic, and I think he was savoring it almost, so that's why he didn't rush through it either. So
we're talking about Galbraith now instead of your stuff, but I don't mind us taking this little detour. If another writer feels the same way I do about it, then I feel validated for it too. And I savored it too. It was a long read, but it was, for me, it was like that little bit of chocolate that I'm not allowed to have every night after dinner. I could sit down and read 20, 30 pages of it and just feel very satisfied by it and enjoy it immensely. So, of course, it's upstairs. I don't have it here in front of me. But if you're going to read the series, and it is a series, I would start at the beginning with The Cuckoo's Calling. And because of the way the co-protagonists, their character arcs and their story arc works, I think it would be a worthwhile investment in your time. So I know I'm giving a plug to Robert Galbraith on your episode. I apologize for that. So let's just get back to Thin Air, if we could. So you're writing it. And are you thinking of writing this as an independent author? Are you thinking about writing this with the idea that you're going to be traditionally published? Where were you sitting with this as you were writing it?
Well, I think the aim was, once the first draft was done, was to get an agent and be traditionally published. And I suppose when you say traditionally published, you probably mean like the big publishing houses and that book being in bookstores, but I was also open to the fact that it might be digital first, or it could be a smaller independent publisher. I think the aim was really just to get published and to get that book out there and to have people reading it, whatever format that took, whether it was digital first, whether it was hardbacks, paperbacks. So it was really just...
E-books.
Yeah, e-books. So it was really just that trying to get an agent and trying to get some sort of deal, whatever shape that deal turned out to be.
Okay. So what happened?
Well, I'm probably going to sound like one of those really annoying people where it seems to happen quite quick for them. But as we pointed out, it was a long process in terms of 20 years of journalism and 10 years of going to the festivals. So basically, I finished the first draft, sent it out to a handful of agents and had a handful of rejections and a couple of agents that didn't get back. And I put the book in a metaphorical drawer for a couple of months and thought, okay, it's been rejected. It's not as good as I maybe thought it was going to be. Should I think about writing something else? But then I thought, I don't really want to trash 80,000 words. So that 2 or 3 months where I set the book aside, that to me was quite important, because when I then went back and read it, I could see everything that was wrong. That distance from it that I didn't have immediately, because I'd been so impatient as soon as I finished the first draft that I just wanted to get it out to agents without taking the time to put it away, let it breathe, go back and have another look at the book. So 2 or 3 months down the line, I could see everything that was wrong with it. I redrafted, which took a few nights. Maybe it wasn't a massive project to do the redrafting. But this time I decided to send it to a book blogger that I knew and 2 author friends to get their feedback before going back down that route with the agents. And one of those authors recommended it to her agent, who was on the original list and who hadn't read the first draft yet. And he really enjoyed the first 3 chapters that I sent, asked to see the full book. And it was a kind of nervous wait over Christmas and New Year. And then the phone call that I'd been waiting for came early February. And he offered representation. The book went out in submission in March. And by Easter, I had an offer from Thomas and Mercer, who are the crime and mystery imprint for Amazon Publishing. So it was quite a quick process once things kind of got up and running, really. So I know I was quite fortunate in that respect with getting the recommendation for the agent and then getting the offer quite quickly after that.
Well, you say you're quite fortunate, but look, you had all that going for you. You know, all those years of writing in some fashion, writing on deadline, writing to audiences, writing, and then also being a very astute reader. And you found your passion in this genre. You had an idea that came to you, not fully baked, something that you had to still, you know, give some time to. You did it. And then the initial rejections actually, my Sicilian friends would say, are now a fart in the breeze. Excuse my French. But that's not French. That's Sicilian, by the way. And now those 3 months or 2 to 3 months was good to allow you to go back and look at it again and basically do a self-edit. And then rather than pushing it out again so you could get flagellated by other agents, you did some beta reading. You sent it out to some author friends and, as you said, a book blogger. And one thing led to another. And yeah, Thomas and Mercer, which I consider to be the penultimate publisher they're in the Amazon. It's an Amazon imprint, yes. But I think they're the penultimate publisher right now, because they have it all working for them. They understand everything that traditional publishers don't. And they have so much more bandwidth than any indie author could possibly have. But now you still had to go through the editing process, and they still had to make a cover for you. And can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Well, yeah. Once I had the offer and the contract was signed, as you say, it then begins that process. So I have what is known as an acquisitions editor, and they are the sort of overseeing editor. But the way things work with Amazon is that you then have a different developmental editor, and then a different copy editor, and then a proofreader. So for the first book, for Thin Air, the developmental editor was a UK editor, but for the 3 books since then, the two that are already out and the one that will be out this year, it's been a different editor, a woman called Charlotte Hersher.
Oh, yes. That's Bob Degoni's.
Yeah, that's right.
Developmental
she
editor.
Is absolutely fantastic. So just the insight that she has been able to bring to those books it's really does just make that book so much better. But it's like everybody else, when you first get the edits back, I think you're kind of hoping that the feedback's going to be, this book's amazing, it doesn't need any work, and then you get 5 pages of edits and you're like, oh, seriously, I've got all this extra work to do, but was there really so much wrong with this book? And then once you kind of get over that and you read the comments and you realise pretty much everything she says is right and is going to make this book so much better.
No, I agree with you 100% about having a good developmental editor, good content editor, structural editor, however you want to term those three things. And then I know that you have some more writing skills than I do, but my copy editor just takes my clunky stuff and makes it just so much smoother. And then, of course, my proofreader does everything to make sure that when it finally gets put into manuscript form for vellum, and that's me as an independent author, that you know everything's done right. The I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, the sentences aren't clunky, and I've done my revisions to make my editor proud. But you're right. You'd want to get this back. You'd like to get that email back or that, email, I guess, in today's world, where they say, this is the greatest, you know, American novel, you know, look out, F. Scott Fitzgerald. We're on the scene now. You want that kind of praise. But then you also realize that these people are very good at what they do. And they've seen so many millions of words. And some things just pop right off the page for them that they can write about, and that they know that if you are serious about your craft, not only are you going to fix them, Lisa, but you're going to make them better. And that's the whole idea, right? And fighting with your editor about the manuscript, I think, is like wrestling with a greased pig, because it just, at the end when it's done, you know, you might just get the idea that the pig likes it. So, I mean, the idea is that you don't get anywhere with, you know, arguing with your editor. You're really just arguing against your own ego. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as you say, it's getting the right editor as well, I think. So I was absolutely delighted when I found out just recently after delivering book 4 in the series that it is going to be Charlotte that's going to be working on that again. So that gives me loads more confidence.
Okay. So now they've polished the apple for you. They made it pretty. And now they put it out into the world. And what happened to Thin Air?
Well, again, I was quite fortunate because it was selected for one of the Amazon promotions called Amazon First Reads, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's people subscribe to an email. And as you know, it's, I think at that time it was 6 books, but by the time I was in the program, it's 8 books that are included in an email that goes out. And you can, if you're a Prime, Amazon Prime member, you get to download one of those books for free, or you can download it for quite a small price. I think it's $1.99. So I was really quite fortunate. I was selected for that promotion. And again, you'd mentioned Robert Degoni, who had been very kind to give me a wonderful quote for the book as well. So that was quite prominent on this promotion. And yeah, the book did amazingly well off the back of that promotion and went to number 1 in the Kindle store in America, UK and Australia. And it also charted on the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal bestseller charts. So it was, yeah, quite unexpected.
Okay. Well, I was going to just laughingly say it, and that's what I expected it to do. It blew your mind, didn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I think that's a fair way to sum it up. Yeah.
I think they knew that they had, in Thin Air, a unique story, and they helped you write it better. But it's all a crapshoot. You don't know. But when they selected it, they knew that they had something that was special there. And I think probably the other 7 books that were in that offering were probably very special too. not to take away from them either. But every, you know, out of thousands and thousands of books, they saw something as being very, very special there. And they pumped it out, you know, with their Amazon machine. I'm not going to take that away from them. But they didn't bend anybody's arm to read it, right? And then you had a ton of readers, and then it just started climbing not only their chart, but as you said, Washington Post and
Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal, yeah, Wall Street Journal. Yeah, no slouch newspapers either in the United States, so by any stretch of the imagination. So I think there's something to be said about that there, that I think you were validated by it. Now, my question is, once you were very much validated by Thin Air, were you intimidated in thinking that you had to come up with the next book and that it had to be as good?
Well, I think that the good thing was that the second book in the series, Bad Memory, was actually written before Thin Air came out. So there was the nervous excitement. How was this going to do? Were people going to stick with that character in that series? But in terms of the actual writing, not so much intimidating, but definitely by the time it came to writing Dark Highway, it felt like there was a lot more pressure.
Sure. Dark Highway is the third.
Yeah.
Bad Memory is the second.
Yeah.
Thin Air was your debut.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great stuff. And I can appreciate what you said about Dark Memory and then the middle book.
Bad Memory.
Bad Memory and the third one.
Dark Highway.
So I mixed them two together. Hey, I'm sorry. Dark Highway, Bad Memory.
Hey, that could be a future title for one of the other books.
There you go. I'm glad I could help you with that, Lisa. I'm glad that I could be one of your author friends that help you with one.
Yeah.
There you go. But thank you for bailing me out on that, too, and being gracious about it. But seriously, you already had the second one in the can. And by in the can, I mean, you know, it was ready to rock. But you had gone through again. You learned how to write better through your developmental editor, you know, copy editor and proofreader. And you had another good idea, and your acquisitions editor helped you with making sure that everything was, you know, that all the tropes were right, and you were hitting on all cylinders. And then you got to write that too as well. So, I guess when you're saying that the third book was when you saw what was happening with the first one, you couldn't change anything with the second because it was already in the pipeline. Now the pressure's on the third one to try to write as well and come up with an interesting story, and that's the one that I have in front of me today. I have to tell you, I love the look inside on this, and I'm going to recommend to all my listeners to do this, the look inside for Dark Highway. First line, I'm going to read it to you. There were four of them in the car, five if you counted the dead woman in the trunk. And that's your opening hook. That was bloody wonderful, as they say in parts of the UK. So,
thank you so much.
Yeah. And who would not want to read the next sentence? And then who would not want to read the next paragraph? And then boom, 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 on it goes. So I just want to tell you that was special. I like that hook. So without giving away a lot, can you tell me a little bit more about Bad Memory and how Jessica moves into the second book and then from the second into the third? And what is this character about? Because I'm very much character-centric with this show. I like to know about what makes the protagonist tick for my readers and what makes them, and why do my writers write them. So tell us about Jessica.
So Jessica's a private investigator. As I mentioned earlier on, she specializes in finding missing persons. And in Thin Air, at the start of the book, finds out that she herself is actually a missing person who was abducted as a child, and people have been looking for her for 20 years, and she never realised. She's also quite a nomadic character. She doesn't have a home, because basically 2 years before the events of Thin Air, her dad had died unexpectedly. She came home from work, found him on the kitchen floor, and despite being quite a young guy, he had died of a massive heart attack. So she kind of like couldn't deal with the grief, that sudden loss. And as far as she knew, her mum had died when Jessica was just a baby in a car accident. So it was always just Jessica and her dad, Tony, for all those years.
Who
so
she abducted her?
Well, that's kind of like you really have to read the book to kind of get the backstory. That's one of the questions that obviously throws up early on, is is this guy really her dad? Who's this guy that raised her? And that's one of the big questions in that book, is she attempts to find out the truth about what happened that night and everybody that was involved in that situation. So as I say, she's kind of someone who, she left New York at that point, sold up in an attempt really to escape her grief and memories. And she moved around from state to state and town to town, just picking up cases as a private investigator to work wherever she kind of happened to find herself next. And then she would move on before she would get too attached to anyone else. So it's almost like a kind of self-preservation. She didn't want to experience that kind of hurt again and get too close to people. So that's kind of a bit what she's about. So she's quite tough and she can be quite abrasive, but she's also, I think, quite vulnerable as well. And as much as she runs away from relationships, I think that's really what she's actually needs. This develops really across the series, I suppose, because there's other characters that are recurring characters. As an LAPD detective, Jason Price, who knew her dad. So again, I don't want to say too much about that relationship. And in the more recent books, there's another private investigator, Matt Connor, who she kind of hooks up with personally and professionally. So yeah, I think she's a character of contradictions in some ways.
Okay. No, I like that. And I think that, you know, you've given us a backstory which allows us to root for our protagonist and see that she's somebody that we want to follow. We want to see what she goes through. And of course, you know, as the more obstacles are thrown in her way, you know, what about her grit and determination to overcome them? And how does she, you know, solve the riddles that are the big questions in the books? And that's the thing that makes reading so interesting, because you get to see almost a flesh and blood person dealing with their own demons, but yet also trying to operate in a very mercurial world where they have to try to sift through everything that's in front of them. And yet with their own flaws, still be able to come up with the clues and work them and get those leads to where they can come to a solution. Do I get that straight? Did I say that right in Jessica's case?
Yeah, that's exactly spot on. I mean, she is described in a lot of the reviews of the books as being quite flawed, but I don't think I'm necessarily set out to write a character that was flawed. I just wanted to write someone that seemed quite real. And I suppose real people have flaws.
Yeah, so that's right. And, you know, and then let's look at the PI stereotype. You know, the hard-drinking, sometimes alcoholic ex-cop who can knock somebody out with one punch and still kiss the other person, all within the confines of the three-act structure. And, you know, I'm not sure that with that trope being there all the time, that you actually describe a real life person with real life feelings and real life backstory, a believable, credible backstory. I think the blurbers or the reviewers are willing to call that flaws. But anyway, so tell us just briefly about the story of, if you can, without giving away all the goodies, about Bad Memory and Dark Highway.
So Bad Memory is the second book in the series, and it's the one that's actually quite different from all the others because it's not a missing persons case. So this one actually centres around a woman who's been on death row for 3 decades, having confessed to the murders of her best friend and her boyfriend when she was a teenager. And she confessed to the crimes back then because all the evidence pointed towards her, and she had these sort of like flashback dreams, but she couldn't actually remember really what happened that night of the weekend of 4th of July 1987, hence the title Bad Memory. So it's one of those, it's a bit more of a race against time. Her sister hires Jessica Shaw with the woman's execution in a week's time, sort of coming up. And basically it's not so much the woman on death row is saying, I'm definitely innocent, I'm definitely guilty. It's more a case of, I need to know what happened that night before this execution happens. So it's kind of a race against time, one for Jessica Shaw to piece together all the pieces and the events that took place over that weekend and try and get to the kind of real answer of what happened to those two other teenagers. So that one's quite different because in Thin Air, it's actually Jessica's investigating her own disappearance. And in Dark Highway, it starts off as one woman who has been missing for 2 months and her parents hire Jessica Shaw and Matt Connor, the other private investigator, to try and find out what happened to this woman who was an artist from Venice Beach. And her camper van was found abandoned on the 29 Palms Highway out in the desert, miles and miles away from Venice. And as they start to look into that investigation, they realise that a number of other women have inexplicably disappeared on that same stretch of highway. And it's to try and establish, is there something that connects them other than the highway? And if so, what's going on and what's actually happened to these women? And the one that I've just finished writing, it'll be out later this year, is a missing person and a murder mystery. So there's a bit of both in that one.
And I'm sorry, did you have the title for that? I apologise.
No, I don't think we've completely decided 100% on what the title of that one's going to be. So I'll just call that Jessica Shaw 4 for now. And that'll be out, I think, round about November.
Okay, well, just have the good people at Thomas and Mercer call me and I'll spitball with them and we'll come up with a good title. So,
yeah.
All right. I'm only kidding, of course. But did the story for your second Bad Memory come to you during the writing of Thin Air, or did it come to you later on?
I actually had a very vague idea for that story when I was offered the first deal with Thomas and Mercer. And at that point, I don't think the editor knew 100%, having read Thin Air, that it was going to be a series. So he asked, is this a series that we think it's got potential with this character and these other cast of characters, that this could be a series if you get something in mind for a second book? And I think it was literally 4 sentences I had for Bad Memory, and my agent sent that across and they says, yep, that sounds good, we'll go with that. And then after that, obviously, it was a bit more involved in terms of developing the outline for that book. But it really just began with this woman who thinks she might have done something really bad, but she doesn't know 100% if she did.
Yeah, if you write a good storyline, it sounds like you did, because if I'm remembering this correctly, Thin Air hadn't exploded on the scene yet. And they're asking you for a second book, possibly, that could lead to a series. You pitch them with a storyline like this, and they like it so much, they say, yeah, we'll invest our time and our effort behind that thought. I think you had a good hook there for them, for Bad Memory. I like it a lot. I like that a lot. And I think that would be, and that just speaks to, again, to a story that people in our genre will want to read, because obviously it has a ticking clock. It gets to use her skills. And she's teamed up now with, like you said, Connor.
Yeah, so she's teamed up with him in book 2. He's not so much in Bad Memory. She's teamed up with him in book 3, Dark Highway. So book 2 is more, the other main character would be Detective Jason Price, who first appears in Thin Air. So he's quite prominent in the second book. And then Matt Connor comes into it. He's, again, without giving too much away about the first book, he first appears in Thin Air, but he becomes more prominent in Dark Highway.
Okay. Well, I apologize for not getting the exact thing right. I'm sorry. I didn't do that right. But it still has legs. I mean, you know, they decided that it was a good idea. Now all you had to do was write the next 80,000 words, right?
Yeah.
Minor point.
Nice and simple.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, yeah, I can do that. Sure. And then you're on to your fourth untitled one. So tell me about what people had to say about Bad Memory and then Dark Highway. Oh, no, Dark Highway's just still out, but please just tell me how they've been received.
Yeah, I think that they've both been received pretty well. So Bad Memory came out, I think, about 4 months after Thin Air. So that helped in terms of, it was really able to ride off the back of the wave of the first book, if you like. So the pre-orders were good after people read Thin Air. And then it was, I think, maybe around just over a year, 13 months between Bad Memory and Dark Highway. But thankfully, I think a lot of readers seem to have stuck with the series and they seem quite excited about another book coming again. So I suppose it's that thing that you really hope to achieve that I kind of mentioned before with characters like Harry Bosch and I suppose people like Jack Reacher and people like that. It's a character that you just, it's almost like catching up with an old friend once that next book comes out, and hopefully that's the way people feel about the Jessica Shaw books, that they look forward to that next book coming out next year and kind of catching up with her and finding out where she is at that point.
Well, I'm going to have to start with Thin Air, because I always like to read first in a series. Many, many years ago, I discovered Lawrence Block mid-series, and I liked his stuff so much that I went back and I ordered from the publisher the little soft covers. And I brought myself up to date, so I started reading from book one all the way up to that book, and then I finished that book. I stopped the book in mid-reading and saying, no, I really like this character a lot. I want to see how this character developed. And this was before I was even a writer, Lisa. So I still have all those little dog-eared paperbacks somewhere in my house, taking me back to the beginning. But I'm going to read you from the beginning. I want to read the character arc, the story arc. I want to go through that, and I want to get into the pre-order for the fourth book too, because I think that sounds like it's a lot of fun. And maybe, just maybe, there'll come a day when I'll send you an email and I'll just say, well, you and Robert Galbraith are tied now for first. So, okay.
No, that would be good. It would be good to have that author's money as well.
Well,
and
yes.
The TV deals.
Yeah, and TV deals and movie deals. And yeah. Lisa Gray, yeah, on the red carpet in Hollywood. Her books have been adapted to, Amazon.
Yeah, I think, yeah, Robert Galbraith's done okay.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
But in any event, how can people get in touch with you? How can people find your books? And to just tell me how they, and if you want to be talking to any of my listeners, how can they reach you?
They can reach me on my website, which is lisagraywriter.com, and they can email me lisa@lisagraywriter.com. And I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter as well. So,
and I've been to your website. It's really pretty. I say pretty. I like it a lot. It's a nice, clean website. It does what it's supposed to do. If people can't push the buy button after they read, you know, about the book blurbs, you know, they see the cover, they read the book blurbs, then they see all that social proof and all those great blurbs to go along with the description. You know, how can they not enjoy, you know, taking a plunge into Thin Air, Bad Memory, Dark Highway, and a title that is going to be named later? So thank you so much for coming on today. I certainly appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been great fun.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our guest next week is Jeffrey Stein. Jeff has over 30-plus years of experience in private investigations, security, security consulting, CCTV, and loss prevention. He is the president and owner of ELPS, Private Detective Agency, and they provide investigative and security services to attorneys, businesses, the cannabis industry, and private citizens. Jeff has personally conducted over 3,000 internal and external integrity and witness interviews during the course of his career. He is a licensed professional investigator in both New Jersey and Pennsylvania. He's also the president of PA Digital Surveillance Systems with over 33 years of in-depth CCTV experience. He's received his Bachelor of Arts degree in Criminal Justice from Westchester University and also advanced training in interviewing and interrogation techniques. He attended the New Jersey State Police Academy, municipal class located in Seeger, New Jersey. He's also board certified as a criminal defense investigator by the Criminal Defense Investigation Training Council and a board accredited investigator. His expertise, while specializing in criminal defense and homicide investigations, spans all the spectrum of private investigation work. In January of 18, he's inducted as a member of the VIDOC Society, and in February of that year, he also was licensed by the Texas Department of Public Safety Continuing Education Instructor for both private investigations and security.
thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you'll find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. If you were either informed, inspired, or entertained by stories today, don't be bashful. Share this link with your friends. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our campfire. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.